got dead, all because of the drunken bastard they depended on to provide for them. He was their father, her husband, and the reason they all died a brutal, untimely death. And some days I wonder why I insist on keeping myself alive. 15. Once I'm back on base, I head straight down. I ignore the soldiers and their salutes as I pass by, paying little attention to the blend of curiosity and suspicion in their eyes. I didn't even realize I was headed this way until I arrived at headquarters, but my body seems to know more about what I need right now than my mind does. My footfalls are heavy. The steady, clipping sound of my boots echoes along the stone path as I reach the lower levels. I haven't been here in nearly 2 weeks. The room has been rebuilt since my last visit. The glass panel and the concrete wall have been replaced, and as far as I'm aware, she was the last person to use this room. I brought her here myself. I push through a set of swinging double doors into the locker room that sits adjacent to the simulation deck. My hand searches for a switch in the dark. The light beeps once before it flickers to life. A dull hum of electricity vibrates through these vast dimensions. Everything is quiet, abandoned, just as I like it. I strip as quickly as this injured arm will allow me to. I still have 2 hours before I'm expected to meet my father for dinner, so I shouldn't be feeling so anxious. But my nerves are not cooperating. Everything seems to be catching up with me at once. My failures, my cowardice, my stupidity. Sometimes I'm just so tired of this life. I'm standing barefoot on this concrete floor in nothing but an arm sling, hating the way this injury constantly slows me down. I grab the shorts stashed in my locker and pull them on as quickly as I can, leaning against the wall for support. When I'm finally upright, I slam the locker shut and make my way into the adjoining room. I hit another switch, and the main operational deck whirs to life. The computers beep and flash as the program recalibrates. I run my fingers along the keyboard. We use these rooms to generate simulations. We manipulate the technology to create environments and experiences that exist entirely in the human mind. Not only are we able to create the framework, but we can also control minute details, sounds, smells, false confidence, paranoia. The program was originally designed to help train soldiers for specific missions, as well as aid them in overcoming fears that would otherwise cripple them on the battlefield. I use it for my own purposes. I used to come here all the time before she arrived on base. This was my safe space, my only escape from the world. I only wish it didn't come with a uniform. These shorts are starchy and uncomfortable, the polyester itchy and irritating. But the shorts are lined with a special chemical that reacts with my skin and feeds information to the sensors. It helps place me in the experience and will enable me to run for miles without ever running into actual physical walls in my true environment. And in order for the process to be as effective as possible, I have to be wearing next to nothing. The cameras are hypersensitive to body heat and work best when not in contact with synthetic materials. I'm hoping this detail will be fixed in the next generation of the program. The mainframe prompts me for information. I quickly enter an access code that grants me clearance to pull up a history of my past simulations. I look up and over my shoulder as the computer processes the data. I glance through the newly repaired two-way mirror that sees into the main chamber. I still can't believe she broke down an entire wall of glass and concrete and managed to walk away uninjured. Incredible. The machine beeps twice. I spin back around. The programs in my history are loaded and ready to be executed. Her file is at the top of the list. I take a deep breath, try to shake off the memory. I don't regret putting her through such a horrifying experience. I don't know that she would have ever allowed herself to finally lose control, to finally inhabit her own body, if I hadn't found an effective method of provoking her. Ultimately, I really believe it helped her just as I intended it to. But I do wish she hadn't pointed a gun at my face and jumped out a window shortly afterward. I take another slow, steadying breath and select the simulation I came here for. 16. I'm standing in the main chamber, facing myself. This is a very simple simulation. I didn't change my clothes or my hair or even the room's carpeted floors. I didn't do anything at all except create a duplicate of myself and hand him a gun. He won't stop staring at me. 1. He cocks his head. Are you ready? A pause. Are you scared? My heart kicks into gear. He lifts his arm, smiles a little. Don't worry, he says. It's almost over now. 2. Just a little longer and I'll leave, he says, pointing the gun directly at my forehead. My palms are sweating. My pulse is racing. You'll be all right, he lies. I promise. 3. Boom. 17.
You sure you're not hungry?
My father asks, still chewing.
This is really quite good.
I shift in my seat, focus on the ironed creases in these pants I'm wearing.
Hmm?
He asks. I can actually hear him smiling. I'm acutely aware of the soldiers lining the walls of this room. He always keeps them close, and always in constant competition with one another. Their first assignment was to determine which of the 11 of them was the weakest link. The one with the most convincing argument was then required to dispose of his target. My father finds these practices amusing.
I'm afraid I'm not hungry. The medicine, I lie, destroys my appetite.
Ah,
he says. I hear him put his utensils down.
Of course. How inconvenient.
I say nothing.
Leave us.
2 words and his men disperse in a matter of seconds. The door slides shut behind them.
Look at me, he says.
I look up, my eyes carefully devoid of emotion. I hate this face. I can't stand to look at him for too long. I don't like experiencing the full impact of how very inhuman he is. He is not tortured by what he does or how he lives. In fact, he enjoys it. He loves the rush of power. He thinks of himself as an invincible entity. And in some ways, he's not wrong. I've come to believe that the most dangerous man in the world is the one who feels no remorse, the one who never apologizes and therefore seeks no forgiveness, because in the end, it is our emotions that make us weak, not our actions. I turn away.
What did you find?
He asks, with no preamble. My mind immediately goes to the journal I've stowed away in my pocket, but I make no movement. I do not dare flinch. People seldom realize that they tell lies with their lips and truths with their eyes all the time. Put a man in a room with something he's hidden, and then ask him where he's hidden it. He'll tell you he doesn't know. He'll tell you you've got the wrong man. But he'll almost always glance at its exact location. And right now, I know my father is watching me, waiting to see where I might look, what I might say next. I keep my shoulders relaxed and take a slow, imperceptible breath to steady my heart. I do not respond. I pretend to be lost in thought.
Son?
I look up, feign surprise.
Yes?
What did you find when you searched her room today?
I exhale, shake my head as I lean back in my chair.
Broken glass, a disheveled bed, her armoire hanging open. She took only a few toiletries and some extra pairs of clothes and undergarments. Nothing else was out of place.
None of this is a lie. I hear him sigh. He pushes away his plate. I feel the outline of her notebook burning against my upper leg.
And you say you do not know where she might have gone?
I only know that she, Kent, and Kishimoto must be together, I tell him. De La Luz says they stole a car, but the trace disappeared abruptly at the edge of a barren field. We've had troops on patrol for days now searching the area, but they found nothing.
And where, he says, do you plan on searching next?
Do you think they might have crossed over into another sector? His voice is off. Entertained. I glance up at his smiling face. He's only asking me these questions to test me. He has his own answers, his own solution already prepared. He wants to watch me fail by answering incorrectly. He's trying to prove that without him, I'd make all the wrong decisions. He's mocking me. No, I tell him, my voice solid, steady. I don't think they'd do something as idiotic as cross into another sector. They don't have the access, the means, or the capacity. Both men were severely wounded, rapidly losing blood, and too far from any source of emergency aid. They're probably dead by now. The girl is likely the only survivor, and she can't have gone far because she has no idea how to navigate these areas. She's been blind to them for too long. Everything in this environment is foreign to her. Furthermore, she does not know how to drive, and if she'd somehow managed to commandeer a vehicle, we would have received word of stolen property. Considering her overall health, her propensity toward physical exertion, and her general lack of access to food, water, and medical attention, she's probably collapsed within a 5-mile radius of this supposed barren field. We have to find her before she freezes to death. My father clears his throat.
Yes, he says. Those are interesting theories, and perhaps under ordinary circumstances they might actually hold true. But you are failing to recall the most important detail.
I meet his gaze.
She is not normal,
he says, leaning back in his chair.
And she is not the only one of her kind.
My heartbeat quickens. I blink too fast.
Oh, come now, surely you'd suspected. You'd hypothesized.
He laughs.
It seems statistically impossible that she'd be the only mistake manufactured by our world. You knew this, but you didn't want to believe it. And I came here to tell you that it's true.
He cocks his head at me, smiles a big, vibrant smile.
There are more of them, and they've recruited her.
No, I breathe.
They infiltrated your troops, lived among you in secret, and now they've stolen your toy and run away with it. God only knows how they hope to manipulate her for their own benefit.
How can you be certain? I ask. How do you know they've succeeded in taking her with them? Kent was half dead when I left him.
Pay attention, son. I'm telling you that they are not normal. They do not follow your rules. There is no logic that binds them. You have no idea what oddities they might be capable of.
A pause.
Furthermore, I have known for some time now that a group of them exists undercover in this area. But in all these years, they've always kept to themselves. They did not interfere with my methods, and I thought it best to allow them to die off on their own without infecting in our civilians unnecessary panic. You understand, of course, he says. After all, you could hardly contain even one of them. They're freakish things to behold.
You knew? I'm on my feet now, trying to stay calm. You knew of their existence all this time, and yet you did nothing? You said nothing?
It seemed unnecessary.
And now? I demand.
Now it seems pertinent.
Unbelievable! I throw my hands in the air. That you would withhold such information from me! When you knew of my plans for her, when you knew what pains I'd taken to bring her here.
Calm yourself, he says.
He stretches out his legs, rests the ankle of one on the knee of the other.
We are going to find them. This barren field Delalue speaks of. The area where the car was no longer traceable? That is our target location. They must be located underground. We must find the entrance and destroy them quietly from within. Then we will have punished the guilty among them and kept the rest from rising up and inspiring rebellion in our people.
He leans forward.
The civilians hear everything, and right now they are vibrating with a new kind of energy. They're feeling inspired that anyone was able to run away, and that you've been wounded in the process. It makes our defenses seem weak and easily penetrable. We must destroy this perception by righting the imbalance. Fear will return everything to its proper place.
But they've been searching, I tell him. My men, every day they've scoured the area and found nothing. How can we be sure we'll find anything at all?
Because, he says, you will lead them. Every night, after curfew while the civilians are asleep. You will cease your daylight searches. You will not give the citizens anything else to talk about. Act quietly, son. Do not show your moves. I will remain on base and oversee your responsibilities through my men. I will dictate to Delalue as necessary. And in the interim, you shall find them, so that I may destroy them as swiftly as possible. This nonsense has gone on long enough, he says, and I'm no longer feeling gracious.
18. I'm sorry. I'm so 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 sorry. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. It was an accident. Forgive me. Please forgive me.
There is little I allow anyone to discover about me. There's even less I'm willing to share about myself. And of the many things I've never discussed, this is one of them. I like to take long baths. I've had an obsession with cleanliness for as long as I can remember. I've always been so mired in death and destruction that I think I've overcompensated by keeping myself pristine as much as possible. I take frequent showers. I brush and floss 3 times a day. I trim my own hair every week. I scrub my hands and nails before I go to bed and just after I wake up. I have an unhealthy preoccupation with wearing only freshly laundered clothes, and whenever I'm experiencing any extreme level of emotion, the only thing that settles my nerves is a long bath. So that's what I'm doing right now. The medics taught me how to bind my injured arm in the same plastic they used before, so I'm able to sink beneath the surface without a problem. I submerge my head for a long while, holding my breath as I exhale through my nose. I feel the small bubbles rise to the surface. The warm water makes me feel weightless. It carries my burdens for me. Understanding that I need a moment to relieve my shoulders of this weight, to close my eyes and relax. My face breaks the surface. I don't open my eyes, only my nose and lips meet the oxygen on the other side. I take small, even breaths to help steady my mind. It's so late that I don't know what time it is. All I know is that the temperature has dropped significantly, and the cold air is tickling my nose. It's a strange sensation to have 98% of my body floating at a warm, welcome temperature, while my nose and lips twitch from the cold. I sink my face below the water again. I could live here, I think. Live where gravity does not know my name. Here I am unbound, untethered by the chains of this life. I am a different body, a different shell, and my weight is carried by the hands of friends. So many nights I've wished I could fall asleep under this sheet. I sink deeper. In 1 week, my entire life has changed. My priorities shifted, my concentration destroyed. Everything I care about right now revolves around one person. And for the first time in my life, it's not myself. Her words have been burned into my mind. I can't stop picturing her as she must have been, can't stop imagining what she must have experienced. Finding her journal has crippled me. My feelings for her have spiraled out of control. I've never been so desperate to see her, to talk to her. I want her to know that I understand now, that I didn't understand before. She and I really are the same in so many more ways than I could have known. But now she's out of reach. She's gone somewhere with strangers who do not know her and would not care for her as I would. She's been dropped into another foreign environment with no time to transition, and I'm worried about her. A person in her situation, with her past, does not recover overnight. And now, one of two things is bound to happen. She's either going to completely shut down, or she's going to explode. I sit up too fast, breaking free of the water, gasping for air. I push my wet hair out of my face. I lean back against the tiled wall, allowing the cool air to calm me, to clear my thoughts. I have to find her before she breaks. I've never wanted to cooperate with my father before, never wanted to agree with his motives or his methods. But in this instance, I'm willing to do just about anything to get her back. And I'm eager for any opportunity to snap Kent's neck. That traitorous bastard. The idiot who thinks he's won himself a pretty girl. He has no idea who she is. No idea what she's about to become. And if he thinks he's even remotely suited to match her, he's even more of an idiot than I gave him credit for. 19. Where's the coffee? I ask, my eyes scanning the table. Delalu drops his fork. The silverware clangs against the china plates. He looks up, eyes wide.
Sir?
I'd like to try it, I tell him, attempting to spread butter on my toast with my left hand. I toss a look in his direction. You're always going on about your coffee, aren't you? I thought I... Delalu jumps up from the table without a word, bolts out the door. I laugh silently into my plate. Delalu carts the tea and coffee tray in himself and stations it by my chair. His hands shake as he pours the dark liquid into a teacup, places it on a saucer, sets it on the table, and pushes it in my direction. I wait until he's finally sitting down again before I take a sip. It's a strange, obscenely bitter sort of drink. Not at all what I expected. I glance up at him.
surprised to discover that a man like Delalu would begin his day by bracing himself with such a potent, foul-tasting liquid. I find I respect him for it.
This isn't terrible, I tell him.
His face splits into a smile, so wide, so beatific. I wonder if he's misheard me. He's practically beaming when he says, I take mine with cream and sugar. The taste is far better that way.
Sugar.
I put my cup down, press my lips together, fight back a smile.
You add sugar to it. Of course you do. That makes so much more sense.
Would you like some, sir? I hold up my hand, shake my head.
Call back the troops, Lieutenant. We're going to halt daytime missions and instead launch in the evening after curfew. You will remain on base, I tell him, where the Supreme will dictate orders through his men. Carry out any demands as they are required. I shall lead the group myself.
I stop. Hold his eyes.
There will be no more talk of what has transpired. Nothing for the civilians to see or speak of. Do you understand?
Yes, sir,
he says, his coffee forgotten.
I'll issue the orders at once.
Good.
He stands up. I nod. He leaves. I'm beginning to feel real hope for the first time since she left. We're going to find her.
Now, with this new information, with an entire army against a group of clueless rebels, it seems impossible we won't.
I take a deep breath, take another sip of this coffee. I'm surprised to discover how much I enjoy the bitter taste of it.
20. He's waiting for me when I return to my room.
The orders have been issued, I tell him without looking in his direction. We will mobilize tonight.
I hesitate.
So, if you'll excuse me, I have other matters to contend with.
What's it like, he asks,
to be so crippled?
He's smiling.
How can you stand to look at yourself, knowing that you've been disabled by your own subordinates?
I pause outside the adjoining door to my office.
What do you want?
What? He says. Is your fascination with that girl?
My spine goes rigid.
She is more to you than just an experiment, isn't she?
He says. I turn around slowly. He's standing in the middle of my room, hands in his pockets, smiling at me like he might be disgusted.
What are you talking about?
Look at yourself, he says. I haven't even said her name, and you fall apart.
He shakes his head, still studying me.
Your face is pale. Your only working hand is clenched. You're breathing too fast, and your entire body is tense.
A pause. You have betrayed yourself, son. You think you're very clever, he says, but you're forgetting who taught you your tricks.
I go hot and cold all at once. I try to unclench my fist, and I can't. I want to tell him he's wrong, but I'm suddenly feeling unsteady, wishing I'd eaten more at breakfast, and then wishing I'd eaten nothing at all.
I have work to do, I manage to say. Tell me, he says, that you would not care if she died along with the others. What?
The nervous, shaky word escapes my lips too soon. My father drops his eyes, clasps and unclasps his hands.
You have disappointed me in so many ways, he says, his voice deceptively soft. Please don't let this be another.
For a moment, I feel as though I exist outside of my body, as if I'm looking at myself from his perspective.
I see my face, my injured arm, these legs that suddenly seem unable to carry my weight. Cracks begin to form along my face, all the way down my arms, my torso, my legs. I imagine this is what it's like to fall apart. I don't realize he's said my name until he repeats it twice more. "What do you want from me?" I ask, surprised to hear how calm I sound. "You've walked into my room without permission. You stand here and accuse me of things I don't have time to understand. I am following your rules, your orders. We will leave tonight. We will find their hideout. You can destroy them as you see fit."
"And your girl," he says, cocking his head at me. "You're Juliet."
I flinch at the sound of her name. My pulse is racing so fast it feels like a whisper.
"If I were to shoot 3 holes in her head, how would that make you feel?"
He stares at me, watches me.
"Disappointed because you'd have lost your pet project? Or devastated because you'd have lost the girl you love?"
Time seems to slow down, melting all around me. "It would be a waste," I say, ignoring the tremble I feel deep inside me, threatening to tip me over. "To lose something I've invested so much time in." He smiles.
"It's good to know you see it that way," he says. "But projects are, after all, easily replaced, and I'm certain we'll be able to find a better, more practical use of your time."
I blink at him so slowly. Part of my chest feels as if it's collapsed. "Of course," I hear myself say.
"I knew you'd understand."
He claps me on my injured shoulder as he leaves. My knees nearly buckle.
"It was a good effort, son. But she's cost us too much time and expense, and she's proven completely useless. This way, we'll be disposing of many inconveniences all at once. We'll just consider her collateral damage."
He shoots me one last smile before walking past me and out the door. I fall back against the wall and crumble to the floor. 21.
Swallow the tears back often enough and they'll start feeling like acid dripping down your throat. It's that terrible moment when you're sitting still, so still, so still, because you don't want them to see you cry.
Crossed out.
You don't want to cry, but your lips won't stop trembling, and your eyes are filled to the brim with please, and I beg you, and please, and I'm sorry, and please, and have mercy, and maybe this time it'll be different. But it's always the same. There's no one to run to for comfort. No one on your side. Light a candle for me. I used to whisper to no one. Someone. Anyone. If you're out there. Please tell me you can feel this fire.
It's day 5 of our patrols and still nothing. I lead the group every night, marching into the silence of these cold winter landscapes. We search for hidden passageways. Camouflaged manholes, any indication that there might be another world under our feet. And every night we return to base with nothing. The futility of these past few days has washed over me, dulling my senses, settling me into a kind of daze I haven't been able to claw my way out of. Every day I wake up searching for a solution to the problems I've forced upon myself, but I have no idea how to fix this. If she's out there, he will find her, and he will kill her, just to teach me a lesson. My only hope is to find her first. Maybe I could hide her, or tell her to run, or pretend she's already dead.
Or maybe I'll convince him that she's different, better than the others, that she's worth keeping alive. I sound like a pathetic, desperate idiot. I am a child all over again, hiding in dark corners and praying he won't find me, hoping he'll be in a good mood today, that maybe everything will be all right, that maybe my mother won't be screaming this time. How quickly I revert back to another version of myself in his presence. I've gone numb. I've been performing my tasks with a sort of mechanical dedication. It requires minimal effort. Moving is simple enough. Eating is something I've grown accustomed to. I can't stop reading her notebook. My heart actually hurts somehow, but I can't stop turning the pages. I feel as if I'm pounding against an invisible wall, as if my face has been bandaged in plastic and I can't breathe, can't see, can't hear any sound but my own heart beating in my ears. I've wanted few things in this life. I've asked for nothing from no one. And now, all I'm asking for is another chance, an opportunity to see her again. But unless I can find a way to stop him, these words will be all I'll ever have of her. These paragraphs and sentences, these letters. I've become obsessed. I carry her notebook with me everywhere I go, spending all my free moments trying to decipher the words she's scribbled in the margins, developing stories to go along with the numbers she's written down. I've also noticed that the last page is missing, ripped out. I can't help but wonder why. I've searched through the book 100 times, looking for other sections where pages might be gone, but I've found none. And somehow I feel cheated, knowing there's a piece I might have missed. It's not even my journal. It's none of my business at all. But I've read her words so many times now that they feel like my own. I can practically recite them from memory. It's strange being in her head without being able to see her. I feel like she's here, right in front of me. I feel like I know her so intimately, so privately. I'm safe in the company of her thoughts. I feel welcome somehow. Understood. So much so that some days I manage to forget that she's the one who put this bullet hole in my arm. I almost forget that she still hates me, despite how hard I've fallen for her. And I've fallen so hard. I've hit the ground, gone right through it. Never in my life have I felt this, nothing like this. I've felt shame and cowardice, weakness and strength. I've known terror and indifference, self-hate and general disgust. I've seen things that cannot be unseen. And yet I've known nothing like this terrible, horrible, paralyzing feeling. I feel crippled, desperate and out of control, and it keeps getting worse. Every day I feel sick, empty and somehow aching. Love is a heartless bastard. I'm driving myself insane. I fall backward onto my bed, fully dressed. Coat, boots, gloves. I'm too tired to take them off. These late-night shifts have left me very little time to sleep. I feel as though I've been existing in a constant state of exhaustion. My head hits the pillow and I blink once, twice. I collapse. 22. No, I hear myself say. You're not supposed to be here. She's sitting on my bed. She's leaning back on her elbows, legs outstretched in front of her, crossed at the ankles. And while some part of me understands I must be dreaming, there's another, overwhelmingly dominant part of me that refuses to accept this. Part of me wants to believe she's really here, inches away from me, wearing this short, tight black dress that keeps slipping up her thighs. But everything about her looks different. Oddly vibrant. The colors are all wrong. Her lips are a richer, deeper shade of pink. Her eyes seem wider, darker. She's wearing shoes I know she'd never wear. And strangest of all, she's smiling at me.
"Hi,"
she whispers. It's just one word, but my heart is already racing. I'm inching away from her, stumbling back and nearly slamming my skull against the headboard, when I realize my shoulder is no longer wounded. I look down at myself. My arms are both fully functional. I'm wearing nothing but a white t-shirt and my underwear. She shifts positions in an instant, propping herself up on her knees before crawling over to me. She climbs onto my lap. She's now straddling my waist. I'm suddenly breathing too fast. Her lips are at my ear. Her words are so soft.
"Kiss me,"
she says. "Juliet,
I came all the way here."
She's still smiling at me. It's a rare smile, the kind she's never honored me with. But somehow, right now, she's mine. She's mine and she's perfect and she wants me and I'm not going to fight it. I don't want to. Her hands are tugging at my shirt, pulling it up over my head, tossing it to the floor. She leans forward and kisses my neck just once, so slowly. My eyes fall closed. There aren't enough words in this world to describe what I'm feeling. I feel her hands move down my chest, my stomach. Her fingers run along the edge of my underwear. Her hair falls forward, grazing my skin, and I have to clench my fists to keep from pinning her to my bed. Every nerve ending in my body is awake. I've never felt so alive or so desperate in my life, and I'm sure if she could hear what I'm thinking right now, she'd run out the door and never come back. Because I want her. Now. Here. Everywhere. I want nothing between us. I want her clothes off and the lights on, and I want to study her. I want to unzip her out of this dress and take my time with every inch of her. I can't help my need to just stare, to know her and her features, the slope of her nose, the curve of her lips, the line of her jaw. I want to run my fingertips across the soft skin of her neck and trace it all the way down. I want to feel the weight of her pressed against me, wrapped around me. I can't remember a reason why this can't be right or real. I can't focus on anything but the fact that she's sitting on my lap, touching my chest, staring into my eyes like she might really love me. I wonder if I've actually died. But just as I lean in, she leans back, grinning before reaching behind her, never once breaking eye contact with me.
"Don't worry,"
she whispers.
"It's almost over now."
Her words seem so strange, so familiar. "What do you mean?"
"Just a little longer and I'll leave."
"No." I'm blinking fast, reaching for her. "No, don't go. Where are you going?"
"You'll be all right,"
she says.
"I promise."
"No." But now she's holding a gun and pointing it at my heart. 23.
These letters are all I have left. 26 friends to tell my stories to. 26 letters are all I need. I can stitch them together to create oceans and ecosystems. I can fit them together to form planets and solar systems. I can use letters to construct skyscrapers and metropolitan cities populated by people, places, things, and ideas that are more real to me than these four walls. I need nothing but letters to live. Without them, I would not exist. Because these words I write down are the only proof I have that I'm still alive.
It's extraordinarily cold this morning. I suggested we make a smaller, more low-key trip to the compounds earlier in the day today, just to see if any of the civilians seemed suspicious or out of place. I'm beginning to wonder if Kent and Kishimoto and all the others are living among the people in secret. They must, after all, have to have some source for food and water, something that ties them to society. I doubt they can grow anything underground. But of course, these are all assumptions. They might very well have a person who can grow food out of thin air. I quickly address my men, instruct them to disperse and remain inconspicuous. Their job is to watch everyone today and report their findings directly to me. Once they're gone, I'm left to look around and be alone with my thoughts. It's a dangerous place to be. God, she seemed so real in my dream. I close my eyes, dragging a hand down my face. My fingers linger against my lips. I could feel her. I could really feel her. Even thinking about it now makes my heart race. I don't know what I'm going to do if I keep having such intense dreams about her. I won't be able to function at all. I take a deep, steadying breath and focus. I allow my eyes to wander naturally, and I can't help but be distracted by the children running around. They seem so spirited and carefree. In a strange way, it makes me sad that they've been able to find happiness in this life. They have no idea what they've missed, no idea what the world used to be like. Something barrels into the backs of my legs. I hear a strange, labored sort of panting. I turn around. It's a dog. A tired, starving dog. So thin and frail it looks like it could be knocked over by the wind. But it's staring at me. Unafraid. Mouth open. Tongue lolling. I want to laugh out loud. I glance around quickly before scooping the dog into my arms. I don't need to give my father any more reasons to castrate me, and I don't trust my soldiers not to report something like this. That I would play with a dog. I can already hear the things my father would say to me. I carry the whimpering creature over to one of the recently vacated housing units. I just saw all three families leave for work and duck down behind one of the fences. The dog seems smart enough to understand that now is not the time to bark. I tug off my glove and reach into my pocket for the Danish I grabbed at breakfast this morning. I hadn't had a chance to eat anything before our early start today, and though I haven't the faintest idea what dogs eat exactly, I offered the Danish anyway. The dog practically bites off my hand. It chokes down the Danish in two bites and starts licking my fingers, jumping against my chest in excitement, finally plowing into the warmth of my open coat. I can't control the easy laughter that escapes my lips. I don't want to. I haven't felt like laughing in so long. And I can't help but be amazed at the power such small, unassuming animals wield over us. They so easily break down our defenses. I run my hand along its shabby fur, feeling its ribs jut out at sharp, uncomfortable angles. But the dog doesn't seem to mind its starved state. At least, not right now. Its tail is wagging hard, and it keeps pulling back from my coat to look me in the eye. I'm starting to wish I'd stuffed all the Danishes in my pocket this morning. Something snaps. I hear a gasp. I spin around. I jump up, alert, searching for the sound. It seemed close by. Someone saw me. Someone... a civilian. She's already darting away, her body pressed against the wall of a nearby unit. Hey! I shout. You there! She stops. Looks up. I nearly collapse. Juliet. She's staring at me. She's actually here, staring at me, her eyes wide and panicked. My legs are suddenly made of lead. I'm rooted to the ground, unable to form words. I don't even know where to start. There's so much I want to say to her, so much I've never told her, and I'm just so happy to see her. God, I'm so relieved.
She's disappeared. I spin around, frantic, wondering whether I've actually begun to lose my grip on reality. My eyes land on the little dog still sitting there, waiting for me, and I stare at it, dumbfounded, wondering what on earth just happened. I keep looking back at the place I thought I saw her, but I see nothing. Nothing. I run a hand through my hair, so confused, so horrified and angry with myself that I'm tempted to rip it out of my head. What is happening to me?
Fracture Me. Chapter 1. Addie? Addie, wake up! Addie! I roll over with a groan and stretch, rubbing both eyes with the heel of my hand. It's too early for this shit. Addie! Still half asleep, I grab James by the collar and yank him down, shoving his head under the blanket. He shouts, and I laugh, wrapping him up in the sheets until he can't get out. Stop it! He whines, little fists pounding against the sheets. Addie, let me out! Hey, how many times have I told you to stop calling me that? James tries to punch me through the blanket. I pick him up and flip him over in my arms and he screams, his legs kicking wildly. You're so mean, he cries, wriggling around in my grip. If Kenji were here, he would never let you... At that, I freeze, and James can feel it. He goes quiet in my arms, and I let him go. He untangles himself from my sheets, and we stare at each other. James blinks. His bottom lip trembles, and he bites down on it. Do you know if he's okay? I shake my head. Kenji is still in the medical wing. No one knows for sure what happened yet, but people have been talking, whispering. I look toward the wall. James is still speaking, but I'm too distracted to pay attention. It's hard for me to believe Juliet could hurt anyone like that. Everyone says he's gone, James is saying now. This I catch. What? I turn back, alarmed. How? James shrugs. I don't know. They said he broke out of his room. What are you talking about? How could he break out of his room? James shrugs again. I don't think he wanted to be here anymore. But what? I screw up my face, confused. Does that mean he's feeling better? Did someone tell you he was feeling better? James frowns. Did you want him to feel better? I thought you didn't like him. I sigh, run a hand through the back of my hair. Of course I like him. I know we don't always get along, but it's really close quarters in here, and he's always got so many damn opinions. James shoots me a strange look. So you don't want to kill him? You're always saying you want to kill him. I'm not serious when I say stuff like that. I try not to roll my eyes. He and I have been friends for a long time. I'm actually worried about him. Okay, James says carefully. You're weird, Addie. I can't help but laugh a little. Why am I weird? And hey, stop calling me Addie. You know how much I hate that. Yeah, and I still don't know why. He cuts me off. Mom always used to call you Addie. Well, Mom's dead, isn't she? My voice has gone hard. My hands are clenched, and when I see the look on James's face, I'm instantly sorry for being so harsh. I release my fists, take a deep breath. James swallows hard. Sorry, he says quietly. I nod, look away. Yeah, me too. I pull a shirt on over my head. So Kenji's gone then, huh? I can't believe he'd just leave like that. Why would Kenji be gone? James asks. I thought you said you didn't even know if he would... But I thought you said... We stop, stare at each other. James is the first to speak. I said Warner is gone. Everyone is saying he escaped last night. Just the sound of his name and I'm already pissed off. Stay here, I say, pointing at James and grabbing my boots. But
Don't move until I get back, I shout before bolting out the door. That bastard, I can't believe this. I'm pounding on Castle's door when Ian spots me on his way down the hall.
He's not in there,
Ian says, still walking. I catch his arm. Is it true? Did Warner really get out? Ian sighs, shoves his hands into his pockets. Finally, he nods. I want to put my fist through the wall.
I gotta go suit up, Ian says, breaking away. And you should too. We're heading out after breakfast.
Are you serious? I say. We're still heading out to fight, even with all this shit going on?
Of course we are, Ian snaps at me. You know we can't wait any longer. The Supreme isn't going to reschedule his plans to launch an attack on the civilians. It's too late to back out now.
But what about Warner? I demand. We're not going to try and find him?
Maybe, Ian shrugs. See if you can find him on the battlefield.
Jesus, I'm so filled with rage I can hardly see straight. I could kill Castle for letting this happen, for being so goddamn soft with him.
Rein it in, man, Ian cuts me off. We've got other problems. And hey,
he grabs my shoulder, looks me in the eye.
You're not the only one who's pissed at Castle, but now's not the time.
I shake him off, shoot him a dark look, and charge.